He said, you are all students of technology. This Krishna consciousness movement is also another technology. Unfortunately, in the modern state of civilization, there are different departments of knowledge. There's a department of teaching medical science. There's a department of teaching engineering. There's a department of educating. So many other departments of knowledge. Unfortunately, there is no department for distributing knowledge in the science of the soul. His proposal was that they should have a department for the study of the soul at MIT. And they must have thought he was out of his mind at the time. You can see from the questions they couldn't really relate to it. This is his conviction that actually what he was presenting, the tradition that comes from the Vedas, is actually a science. And so I'm going to make that case. Right now, in our modern world, we've got these two divisions. That's what he said. Unfortunately, we've got science, and then we've got religion. You go to a church or a temple, a mosque, an institution like that, and what's that's based on faith. Whereas a university like this, you have things go on that's called science, and that's based on knowledge. One has books of knowledge. They used to be in science, I guess, at one time, big books of knowledge like Newton's Principia and things like that. Nowadays, the books of knowledge of science are articles and technical journals. But what you get is everyone agrees this is knowledge. Whereas in an institution like mine, we have books like the Bhagavad Gita and so on. We call them scripture. Different kind of thing than books of knowledge. Of course, the from the Hindu tradition, there is a group of books that we would call today scripture, but they go by the name of Veda. These are the Vedas: Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda. But the word Veda actually means knowledge. These are books of knowledge. To the people that actually use them and live by them, they were, in fact, they're handbooks that contain all kinds of knowledge. The Vedas, by the way, have parts of it that deal with, well, Ayurveda deals with medical science, Dhanurveda deals with political science, and so on. Those things that we would recognize now as secular endeavors were all part of the same body of knowledge, which also had in it the Upanishads, which deal with things that we would now say are part of a religion. But it's really a product of secularization that now we are in a situation where we have separated religion from our lives. We have this separate category of things called religion, which is a sort of addendum or a supplement to our regular lives. I go through my life, and then on Sunday I do the thing that is my religion off to the side, and I don't let it interfere with the really important things, such as the acquirement of power and money. We we keep religion out of that stuff. You can be as religious as you want to be, but just keep it off to the side, like it's your kind of your hobby. But this is, it didn't used to be like that. It used to be that actually there was no difference between people's, what we would call their religion, and what their lives were. But we shouldn't read this back into the past. When Krishna was teaching the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, he did not think, now I'm going to speak a scripture of the Hindu religion. Any more than when Jesus was speaking to his people in Palestine, he wasn't thinking, now I'm going to speak a scripture of the Christian religion. But both of them, they were just telling the truth. They were giving what they considered to be knowledge. Now we have somebody like Srila Prabhupada, who comes to MIT and says, why don't you have a department of the soul? And he's making the claim that actually what he's offering, what he's teaching, or what people like me are teaching is actually knowledge. It's science. So I want to make that case. First of all, this contrast we make between faith on the one side and knowledge on the other is really false. We think that here you have something solid and real, that's knowledge, and here when you don't have knowledge, you have this kind of second class or third class substitute for knowledge, which is what you call faith. Knowledge is reliable, faith is not reliable, and so on. But you should know, actually, that the two are linked very, very closely together, and that all processes of knowledge actually begin in faith and proceed by faith, any process of knowledge. This is recognized in the Bhagavad Gita, by the way. There's one passage, I think it's in the 17th chapter. Krishna says, Shraddhamaya ayam purushaha. The human being is Shraddhamaya. He is made of, or composed of, or constituted by Shraddha, by faith. You know who was fond of quoting that passage? Was J. Robert Oppenheimer, who's also famous for quoting the Bhagavad Gita when the first atomic explosion went off. He was a fan of the Bhagavad Gita. Well, this is another thing. Not only did he quote the I am become death, the destroyer of the world, but he also used to quote this one. A human being is made of faith. He's composed as his nature. And if you look at it, you'll see, if you just take a simple thing, that any process of knowledge, it starts with faith. If you sign up for a chemistry course, and you sit down in a lecture hall, and there's some guy you've never seen before in your life, and he stands up and he starts talking to you about all kinds of things, protons, electrons, neutrons, electron shells, covalent bonds, all these metaphysical entities, and tells you all these things about these invisible beings, and you just sit down and you write it all down because you have faith.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that that's fine as someone who's, as a student, obviously you don't know, but that's grounded in something that's been proved.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that, sure. Say you're a skeptic. Say you're a skeptic, you know. I mean, when we start with faith, we write it all down because, you know, this is an authorized university and this is an accredited guy, and so you say to him, how do I know this is true? And he says, well, we have experiments to show that it's true. He said, this is not like religion. he said, because this is science. It's, they like to use the word democratic. It's open to everybody, and any result we have is replicated, and so you can actually prove it for yourself. Can I do that? Yeah, sure. But before you can do the experiments, first you have to learn the science. See, all you see is a cathode ray tube with a little pattern of dots on it. That's all you actually see. But to know the meaning of what those little dots on the cathode ray tube and all that equipment is, you have to learn the science. So it will take you at least 7 years of learning the science. And anyway, we don't let anybody go near that machinery until the third year of graduate school anyway. So as it turns out, for all those years before you can do the experiment, you proceed by faith. And you can actually do the experiment after you've really assimilated the whole thing for yourself, on faith, or that's the strong component of it, all along. And you find out actually that's mostly how it does. I mean, on the cutting edge of any scientific field, there's maybe a dozen or two dozen people that are doing the real work, who publish the stuff, and there's maybe another 100 that understand it, and everybody else just accepts it on faith, because actually it's not open to everybody, it's open to the adepts, those who have been initiated into the process and are now able to do these esoteric experiments that very, very people understand. They have these obscure mantras written in a symbology that they cannot translate into ordinary English at all. They use word like string and quarks and things like that. They're absolutely meaningless words. It's only mathematics that a few people understand. And anyway, this is how it goes on. So it's a fact that there are certain commitments at the very beginning. The idea that you find in the Bhagavad Gita, in the very beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, there's a discussion of, really the Bhagavad Gita is very enlightening on this, because really what there's a discussion about is how faith is placed. There's actually a systematic understanding of the correct placement of faith. It's not just a blind thing, but the instrument for placing faith in the Vedic scheme of things is called buddhi. What we would call the psychic or the mental part of the person is in Sanskrit something that has three divisions. Manas, which is translated as mind. Buddhi, which is usually translated as intelligence, or the faculty of discrimination. And then ahankara, your idea of your fundamental rooted idea of yourself. And this buddhi is actually the agent for the placement of faith. And simple experience is always guided by presuppositions. When you walk into a room, what do you notice and what do you not notice? What is important, what is not important? What's interesting, what's not interesting? What attracts your attention? What do you ignore? A lot of times you find that people have been investigating some particular area of the material world, and there's been something in front of their faces for years and they never thought it was important. Suddenly they realize it's important. It was always in front of their face and never registered. Suddenly it becomes significant. So there's this structure of perception, and the structure of knowledge is predetermined by actually our existential condition of life, what we are interested in or what we are not interested in, what we aim at, what we don't aim at, and how do we make these choices? How do we make these choices? Well, actually, they are determined by buddhi, or what would appear to us as acts of faith. By the way, they're acts of faith that we don't even usually realize we've committed ourselves to. Everyone, as the Bhagavad Gita said, is made of or composed of or characterized by having some faith. People will claim that they don't have faith, they have knowledge or something else, but they're just not very self-aware of their commitments. Usually, like when I studied philosophy, one thing I learned very early on is the most powerful ideas that a philosopher presents are the ones he never states, because they just presume these things, because everybody knows it, nobody questions it. It's built into a structure of knowledge. Even if he tries to be self-critical, it's still there. And you always look for the things that are never stated, but always implied to see like that. So, I want to talk about the faith of modern science. Now, when my spiritual master said a science of the soul or a science of the self, he was thinking of a Sanskrit word, actually, that translated as science, and that's called vijnana. In Sanskrit, there's two words, jnana, which generally means knowledge, and vijnana, the prefix vi, vijnana, is a kind of all-purpose intensifier in Sanskrit. But what it means in this context is not just knowledge you have gained from books, but knowledge you've gained by your own experience. It's experienced or ascertained or realized knowledge. It's direct perception. He talks about the science of the soul, he means that process by which one can gain direct perception of such things, the soul, or God for that matter. So the question is, how is such experience possible? And the other thing is, do you want it? Is it of interest to you? Because right now, most of us think it's not possible, because we doubt that such things like the soul or the Atma or Paramatma, or what people call God, these are not really, they're imaginary. They're not possible objects of experience for us. And maybe we're not interested in such experiences. Maybe the experiences we're interested in, those that bring us wealth or power or fame or something like that. Maybe this is not something that attracts us. But in a way, the faith of modern science has eliminated these things for us, because I want to talk about this faith of science. Let us call, I'm going to take three divisions. I'm sorry I don't have a blackboard here. But in Sanskrit, a cultivation of knowledge is put into divided into three parts, or three divisions. This is a way of understanding Vedanta as having three topics. The topics in Sanskrit are called Sambandha, Abhidheya, and Prayojana. The word Sambandha means knowledge of relationships, basically of what there is in the world, or in much the world, but what there is in reality. What are the components and the relationships of the components of existence to each other? This is called sambandha, sambandha gyan, knowledge of the relationships. Abhideya means acting on the basis of those relationships. And prayojana means the goal that you are trying to reach by acting on those relationships. The sambandha is sort of like a map of reality. Abhideya is the journey you take using that map. And then prayojana is the destination or the goal you hope to achieve by doing it. So if we can use these same categories for dealing with what we now call knowledge, that is to say, modern science. So the sambandha of science, what is there in reality? First thing is that we should understand that science really abstracts from our experience of the world with regard to numbers. Science has become very powerful the more it can do this. This computer, it works because people have learned how to turn a great deal of reality in a string of ones and zeros. It's a way of taking things and reducing it to numbers. So science does this. I mean, there's no problem with doing that. But sometimes they forget that actually you've abstracted from experience. And you become interested in the world so long as you can measure it and therefore express it in numerical terms. How heavy is it? How light is it? How fast is it? How slow is it? How long is it? How short is it? How tall is it? How hot is it? How cold is it? And then you express it in terms of numbers. But then there's also a kind of ideology that goes along with this a lot of times. You've forgotten you've abstracted from experience. You find that dealing with the world in terms of numbers is in fact very, very powerful. You can do a lot of things. You've got using numbers. You've got a set of tools that you can bring to bear in the material world, and you start to feel powerful. Then you start to think, you make another step, which is that numbers becomes the key to all reality. If you cannot express it in terms of numbers, it either doesn't exist or it's not significant. There's a kind of ideology that goes this. So you go from maybe in the beginning that numbers are very useful to numbers as definitive of reality. So what this leads to ultimately is the objectification of the world. That is to say, a denial of the subject. You know the word objectification, it's of course become well known now. There's an interesting definition of it. To present a regard as an object. And this dictionary gives us Barry Lopez. I don't know if you know him, an environmentalist writer. He says, because we have objectified animals, we are able to treat them impersonally. In other words, they're not subjects, but they are holy objects. Because this is what happens. We tell ourselves a story like this, that the whole of reality is such that simply by measuring, by numbers, we can gain a complete understanding of creation. And so then we tell us our story like this, that all there is in the world are basically structures of matter. And these structures of matter simply over the course of time become more and more complex. For some reason, nobody knows why, but they just increase in complexity. An anti-entropic branch system. This world was once defined in a philosophy course. It's anti-entropic. The thing, instead of things becoming more disorganized, things are for some reason becoming more and more organized. So you get more and more complex structures of reality. And then structures reach a certain level of complication, then something else pops into existence. And this is a very weird step. What pops into existence is simply not more complicated structures of reality, but something of an entirely different nature, entirely different ontological category, which is the experience of structures of reality. Of structures of matter. It's not just another structure, it's the experience of structures of matter. How does something of an entirely different category come into existence? If all you have is structures of matter, that's all you should get. But now you suddenly have the experience of structures of matter. This is what we call consciousness. And really, for modern materialistic science, consciousness is a problem. Because it cannot be measured, cannot be expressed in terms of numbers, and usually the effort is to try to get rid of it. Right now, because of brain imaging and everything like that, they just simply want to deal with neurological functions. And because then we can handle it, and so you trace it back to things that are happening in the brain. And that's all you want to talk about. Or, of course, people involved with artificial intelligence really wish to say that there is no such thing as consciousness. It becomes a problem because there's structures of matter, and then there's the consciousness of structures of matter, and people cannot figure out how to fit them together into the same whole. Anyway, this is part of the process of objectification, the denial of the subject. We'll get to this. Now, so this is the sambandha, the relationships of science is basically the structures of matter and things becoming more and more complicated structures of matter through some kind of various levels of evolution, molecular evolution, chemical evolution, biological evolution, and so on. Then the method for getting to where you want to go is the experimental method, empiricism, a measuring tendency to judge everything by our senses and to measure it. And then where do you want to go with it? Prayojana, the impetus of science, to what do you want to really achieve by it, is ultimately the control of material nature, a mastery. To kind of lord it over and to control that. This is what one hopes to be able to do. So in a way, we have to say, as far as things like the soul and God, it's not that science disproves the existence of these things. It's rather they're eliminated from the game at the outset. I once read an account of a group of cosmologists in Washington, D.C. having a conference, and the cosmologist, somebody at this conference, this was like 20 years ago, somebody at this conference presented a mathematical argument that given the amount of available time, if the conditions of the conditions at the beginning of the universe were completely at random, then there was nowhere near enough time by random processes for anything like the amount of order in the universe to arise. It just couldn't happen. These are the kind of arguments that are still being made now by these intelligent design people, these sort of mathematical arguments. Anyway, this fellow suggested in this conference that he proposed that at the very beginning there must have been some order, that things in the beginning were not entirely at random. So then there ensued a discussion between two groups, the people that believed or were at least arguing in favor of some order in the very beginning. This was called the stacked deck theory of the universe, as opposed to the shuffled deck theory of the universe. And the article that reported this conference said it then came down to the question, the problem with the stacked deck theory of the universe was, how did it get stacked? When there's some order in the beginning, you want to look for a cause. And the article reported that somebody actually mentioned God. And then it said, and I quote exactly the words of the article, but most scientists prefer not to take that cop-out route. You see, it's not that it's disproven. It's just that it breaks the rules of the game. It's like you saw some people playing tennis and you see them struggling to get this ball across the net, and you say, look, you know, get rid of the net, it'll make it a lot easier. No, we need the net. So there's certain just ground rules for science, and one of those ground rules is this cannot be admitted. That somehow without God we're going to be able to explain and account for everything. That's a kind of a faith. So the result of this outlook is that the reality of something that we would call spiritual becomes very, very remote to us. It says that we are also simply structures of matter. There's no more reality to us than simply that. We're simply a very complicated structure of things. And then when we hear this idea of spirit as opposed to matter, or the soul, or things like that, we have no idea what people are talking about. It's just not locatable in our universe that's been defined by our presuppositions, by our faith, actually. That soul is beyond any possible experience, or God for that matter. But since now, how can we locate such a thing as spirit or soul in the universe? Well, according to the Vedas, not only do we experience the soul or the self, but it's the very condition for our having any experiences whatsoever. Because the presence of soul is shown by the existence of consciousness. Now, consciousness is something I think we know what it is. Let's take this bottle of water. Here's the thing that's occupying space in this room, right? Just like my body is occupying space in this room. But the difference is that here in this structure of matter occupying space in the room, there's somebody at home. I undergo experiences. By consciousness, I mean this capacity, this capacity to undergo experiences. In other words, I'm not just an object, but I'm also a subject. This bottle of water is entirely an object. It does not undergo experiences. It doesn't. I have significance for myself. This has only significance for others. So this is where we identify what we mean by consciousness, or to be a subject, not just to be an object, is that you have significance for yourself. You are undergoing experiences. So by consciousness, we do not simply mean the more highly developed human self-awareness. There's consciousness, according to this, in animals, birds, even plants. They have some degree of awareness. They undergo experiences. They have lives of their own. So, actually, there's a famous passage in Western philosophy where David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, looks for himself. He describes, he's introspecting, and he's looking into himself, and he sees memories, ideas, impressions, feelings, sort of floating around, bundles of things, but anywhere he looks, he cannot find anything he would call a self. It's a very, very famous passage. It's a sort of the bundle theory. There's not one thing that's a self, but in this kind of interior space, there's all these what we call mental objects. No self. He reports no self. It's just like you remind somebody going into a dark storehouse with a flashlight, looking around, you know, and seeing all the objects. Because we would say, I would say to David Hume, wait a minute, who's looking? Who is looking? There is a center of consciousness that is going around looking and seeing and witnessing, who's the witness of all his interior activities. And according to the Vedic idea, that one who is the witness or the seer who's conscious, that's actually the self. And it's true, you have to draw the boundary between the self and the not self. The self is the Atma, is that which experiences, and the object of experiences, that's the not self. So conventionally, we draw the boundary here at the skin. Huh? My experience of the world, I have my sense organs, which are arrayed around my body. And this is what I am, this is my environment, and here I am, and here's the boundary. But at the same time, I'm also conscious that my eyes are seeing, that my ears are hearing, that my hands are moving. So you have to say that in that case, my body is actually the not self. It is my environment. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, the self, the body, is called the kshetra, the field. And the soul, or the self, is called the kshetragya, the knower of the field. So the body is the field. But the body also is this manas, buddhi, and ahankara, those things that David Hume were looking at. I can as well introspect, and I can watch my mental operations take place, just like David Hume was seeing. And we have to conclude then also that the mind is the not-self. And in fact, it's very useful to understand that we can define the body as that part of material nature to which we are the most closely related. And of that, our real environment is what in Sanskrit they refer to as the subtle body. In other words, the gross and subtle body is a psychophysical unity, part of the same causal system. So the self is not the structures of matter. The structures of matter also concern thinking and feeling and willing and all those things like that. That's also not us. That's our environment. Our mind, our own mind, is our environment. And this, by the way, is where the environmental movement should begin. To clean up the mind. So we're pulling that back, the boundary between the self and the not-self, like this, until we actually, in this way, we can isolate this experiencer. So the Bhagavad Gita gives a map in this way. It's sambandha, it's map of reality. Is first of all, there's matter. And in the Bhagavad Gita, it's listed like this: gross matter, earth, air, fire, water, and ether, which really sounds primitive. But we could put it in more sophisticated terms, if you like. Solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, and space. Going from the gross, or the most apparent to our senses, to the most subtle. Space is considered, akasha, is considered a material element in this thing. Empty space. A friend of mine who's a mathematician says it takes many pages of quantum mechanics to describe empty space. So it's not nothing. Well, anyway, this is earth, water, fire, solids, liquid, gases, radiant energy, and space. And then the other component of material nature, which is even more subtle or hard to perceive, this manas, buddhi, ahankara. Mind, intelligence, and false ego. All these, Krishna says, this is my separated material energy. So that's the one thing. That's the structures of matter. So far as we know, material science only deals with the first five of these material elements. So far, it hasn't figured out how to deal with manas, buddhi, ahankara. Not very well. Somewhere, at least in living bodies, there's interaction. We know there's interaction. We know, for example, that if I become angry, which is an activity of the mind, that my face gets red, my blood pressure goes up. We know that there in this body-mind affects matter. And conversely, if I drink a glass of alcohol, which is a gross element, it'll certainly affect my subtle body. So these two are part of the same causal system. So that's one energy. Then there's another energy. This is where the composed of all the living entities or the conscious beings. See, they don't, the souls do not arise out of matter. Rather, they flow together into matter and are united together. Now, both these two energies, so we are not our bodies, we are not our minds. We are given these things like it's like you pick up a car from the rental agency and you drive it around. We didn't make these bodies, we didn't produce them, but suddenly they're here for us and they do so many things. They run for a while, the warranty wears out, they start to break down, and then you have to change them. That's what happens. We keep on going, according to the Bhagavad Gita. Because the conscious beings are quite different. So both of these energies come from a single source, according to the Bhagavad Gita, which Krishna identifies as himself, the absolute truth, the ultimate source of all energies. So that's the map of reality, matter and spirit, and then the origin of both. So, this map allows us to understand who we are and our problems of material existence. That we are actually as the soul. Right now we can experience the soul at least as consciousness. Now, it's possible to explore the soul further. But one has to be, the conditions have to be there. Again, it's a science. And the people that practice science said this knowledge, which is right now not available to us, is because we do not have the existential qualifications. According to the Bhagavad Gita, knowledge, that is to say knowledge of the soul, knowledge of God, and so on, depends upon sattva, that is to say on goodness, on purity. Scientific knowledge, as it's been developed now, is more or less based on the mode of rajas or passion. It directs us to the senses and to the satisfaction of the senses. It says that we have no existence beyond our material existence, and therefore any happiness that we're going to be is going to be found will only be by trying to control and manipulate material nature. This is not really the way to go. The more we try to control material nature, we should know by now, the more deeply entangled we become in her complexities. But the science of the Bhagavad Gita, it also sets out a map. And by this map, one can understand who I actually am. And then one can now begin to develop the consciousness. That is to say, consciousness can be intensified and can be enlarged. It can be increased more and more. So there's certain preconditions or existential conditions by which this realized knowledge becomes possible, whether it becomes knowledge of the self and ultimately knowledge of the super self that can be explored. But the conditions are there. When they say sattva, it means goodness. That's why there's some, you could say, The whole science is called Buddhi Yoga, in the Bhagavad Gita, where one acts in the world without being attached to the results of the action. It's quite different from the modern world where everybody is acting, but trying to attain the fruits of their action, so they can enjoy whatever they get. One has to act in a different way, not trying to satisfy desires, but ultimately to become free from desires. This is the condition. Under those kind of conditions, then this knowledge becomes possible. If we do not have those conditions, it will not be possible. These things like the soul, like the super soul or God, they'll become merely abstractions for us. So this is the neglected part of science right now. It is not that material science, as we have it, is wrong or useless. The difficulty is that it is incomplete. It's got a grip on a little part of reality, but the mistake is that one takes what little bit one knows and thinks, this now I have the key to all and everything. And so we need to come to an ultimately unified science that has both the knowledge of matter and also the knowledge of spirit, and together cultivate it side by side. Okay, I'm just talking for longer than I should have. Any questions or comments? That means you all agree. Our standard of advancement of civilization, how we measure our advancement of civilization right now, is the standard of the mode of passion. It's mostly about economic development, usually the success or achievement of any country, any administration. It's the economy, stupid, right? It's all the standard of, are we better off than we used to be? Are we advancing? It's all based on economic figures. And that's the definition of happiness. Our duty as Americans is to consume as much as possible. That's the engine that runs the economy. If you adapted the standard of the Bhagavad Gita, there would probably be a major economic collapse. Let us not buy anything unnecessary. Let us not consume. Let's try, instead of trying to increase our desires, let us try to minimize our desires. This is the beginning of actually. So there's another, it used to be the standard of advancement was the standard of the mode of goodness. There's three modes of material nature that are called goodness, passion, and ignorance. But you see it everywhere. When things are being created, material nature is said to be in the mode of passion. When things are being maintained, it's called sattva-guna, the mode of goodness. And when things are being destroyed, or rotting, or decaying, or falling apart, this is called the mode of ignorance. And it's a cycle. Then again, there's a creation and maintenance and destruction and so on. This is the cycle of nature. But also, we are psychologically conditioned by the modes of nature. So right now, even our consciousness is conditioned by these modes of nature. Usually we're a mixture of different modes. But just to give an example, the mode of passion we know very well, because our whole civilization is built on the mode of passion. That is to say, our consciousness is fairly narrowly and excitedly focused on the objects of desire. That's consciousness in the mode of passion. We want this and we want that and we're working for it. And that object of desire, we only relate things and see the world in terms of whether it serves this purpose or not. This is the mode of passion. Of course, the exemplary act of the mode of passion is sexual activity. But what goes along with it is economic development and so on. The desire for profit, adoration, distinction. So this is the mode of passion. Consciousness in the mode of ignorance is oblivious, doesn't know what's happening. It's depressed, bored, not very alert, not very interested, not active, but morose, depressed, often intoxicated. This is the mode of ignorance. Consciousness in the mode of goodness is detached, disinterested, but extreme disinterested in the sense of not after anything in the world, but extremely alert and attentive to everything. This is consciousness in the mode of goodness. So that it's not that attention is not guided by desires to enjoy, but simply this inquisitiveness to know and to understand. Without any notion of getting anything out of it except maybe knowledge for its own sake. This is the mode of goodness. So the mode of goodness is the condition by which one can actually develop in spiritual knowledge. I mean, you could be relative about it. You know, let's hear it for the mode of passion, or let's hear it for the mode of ignorance. You know, that's our standard. Why should one be better than the other? But according to the Bhagavad Gita, which analyzes these things, that in the mode of goodness, one actually becomes happy. And knowledge develops. In the mode of passion, the result of the mode of passion is misery. Because in the mode of passion, desires increase and multiply, and none of them can be satisfied. You see a person who's intent on making $1 billion by the age they're 22. When they have $1 billion, do they stop? No, now they want two. It just goes on and on and on. There's no end to it. So the result of the mode of passion is misery. And the result of the mode of ignorance is insanity. And so usually people in the mode of passion, as they become more and more miserable, you can try to remedy it by going to the mode of goodness, or usually what happens is you sink down into the mode of ignorance, alcohol, drugs, things like that. Where people actually are seeking unconsciousness as a relief from the miseries of their lives. And you can see that's happening. According to the World Health Organization, the number one health problem in the world today is mental illness. This is because people are becoming actually more and more unhappy. And it's driving them crazy. We would advocate for people's well-being as the standard of the mode of goodness, but we are not in a civilization that's conducive to it. I mean, turn on any television, look at the Fox Network. You know, not going to help anybody go anywhere but further into passion and ignorance. But look at what student life is like. And what student life used to be like, in the days when the standard was the mode of goodness, was quite different. So that's why these things that are advocated in the Bhagavad Gita right now, they do not seem real or tangible to us. Actual spiritual life, actual detachment from the world, the happiness that comes from that. We think that you can only become happy by trying to satisfy all your desires. Whereas actually it's just the opposite. Anyway, that's some idea about these modes of material nature. Anyway, you should think about it. And ultimately it's a question of where you place your faith. What's given in the Bhagavad Gita, or for that matter, not just the Bhagavad Gita. You can go to the Tao Te Ching. You can go to the writings of Saint Augustine. You will find that there's rather universal agreement on the basic fundamental principles of spiritual science across the board. There's a huge body of knowledge on the spiritual level that's already piled up. What really has to be done is now it has to be, unfortunately in the past people have been divided by culture and have been somehow or other caught up in unimportant differences. Now at least the advantage of today is that the world is becoming more unified, communication across all kinds of cultural and temporal differences are being broken down. And the conditions are there where you could actually have a unified spiritual science. And there's a way to take the spiritual knowledge from the Buddhist traditions, the Christian traditions, the Hindu traditions, the Chinese traditions, and to make it Islamic traditions, Jewish traditions, and put it into a systematic framework of spiritual science. I'm convinced of that. And when that is done, that'll become very, very powerful. Okay, thank you very much.